Orkney. It begins with the journey. There is an airport at Kirkwall on the main island of Orkney, but the flights are often somewhat mythically delayed by the rampant sea fogs that enshroud the flat boglands of the runway. Stories are told of world-weary camera crews being confounded by the unreliability of Orcadian air travel. Pilots may take the plane up to have a look, but return to the Scottish mainland to await improved weather. Or unfortunate pilots who have miscalculated their landing in the wet mists and required a boat to tow them out of the bog. But the real journey, the journey that defines Orkney for me, is the one by ferry across the broiling seas and whirlpools of the Pentland Firth. Then you do not stumble into Orkney as you might stumble blinking and deranged from the doors of a 737. You are translated and transformed through the sea, from the flow country of the Caithness peats and moors to a land of few trees, to a land where even the hardy hawthorn bushes are drawn tightly into the lee of the ever-present wind, to a land of oil tankers, prehistoric villages, and fleets of scuttled ships. Orkney is not a place of romantic idyll. It endlessly resists idyllic ease, but a harsh place of historic tales. If there is romance here, then it is in the voluptuous midnight storms, the burning red eye of the flotter oil terminal flare. This is the place where Sand 14 is located, the company and extraordinary design house for mobile devices where I made my future archaeology of the mobile telecoms industry. Orkney. It began with thick mists on the northern horizon as we set out from the northeast tip of Scotland aboard the Hamnavoe. The mists never parted, as they might in a pre-Raphaelite tale of the mist-hidden island of Avalon. They never thinned, only steadily darkened. And then, after many minutes standing hood up on deck, gloved hands fitted to the white railings, there the dark mists gathered form, and the towering cliffs of Hoy were before us, vast, Jurassic, their cliff tops lost in the mist, the red and green wall of rock passed silently, rotoscoping before our eyes. Tumbling long streams, falling hundreds of metres, hung like heavily jewelled primeval spiderwebs. The stack of the old man of Hoy, mouth open in breath, greeted us with his unspoken voice from far above. And in amongst the swirling flat seas, puffins dove in and out of the water, black wings flapping madly in their comic, flustered agitation. Then the cliffs faded, and on the port side, low grey buildings and low green hills materialised and drew in all around us as we slid into dock at Stromness with a fanfare of ferry horns. I had lent the ethnographer a windproof jacket and fleece, which she had zipped herself into since the rains of our stopover in the Lake District and had barely removed since. Now she sat hunched into the high collar, eyes bright, quietly waiting in the passenger side of the Land Rover for the ferry doors to open. I smiled with anticipation. Orkney's rocks and waters had been impressed over the long ages with a peculiar magnetic field, one that aligned the bones of visitors into those who were drawn closer and those who were repelled. The ethnographer, I was certain, would be drawn in. The Land Rover joined the flood into the harbour front, but I slew to a crawl as we passed the nondescript annex and apex of Julia's Cafe, which was one of Sand 14's regular haunts and local supplier of good cake and lunch. No one I recognised was sitting at the usual harbourside table, so I pushed the Land Rover back up to speed over the hump of Stromness and headed out of the town, past the geodesic dome greenhouses and the pebble dash bungalows that seem to be the basic building blocks of island life. How to describe the next moment? The first moment, as you come over the rise of the hill and the gleaming magnificence of the Loch of Stromness and the Loch of Harrow stretch before you, with the sliver tail of the isthmus between, an isthmus upon which the teeth of the Ring of Frogger stone circle set their jaw against the sky. The moment caught us both, I knew, and in that moment something of the two of us was left hanging in the damp air, a memory, a connection. But the Land Rover was homing in on Sand 14, drawn ever more rapidly towards its usual resting place in the land below. So we swept on down in a wide curve around the edge of the loch, passing the small grass dome of a prehistoric passage grave by the loch side, entering the bounds of the World Heritage Site and one of the densest proliferations of Neolithic monuments known. The curve drew us on past the cream walls of the hotel I had stayed in during my first few weeks here, waking up to a view that looked out across the loch at the silhouette of jagged stone teeth on the horizon. The isthmus was racing in towards us, and I pointed to the little shingle beach in the crook of the spit of land that reached out towards the curving tail. I could just see the black crescent moon of a seal asleep on the dark rocks, head and tail curved to the sky. Set before the seal was a vast semicircular window glinting off the brackish water, its frame deeply embedded into a large grass-covered mound. The broad circular mound spread out towards the edges of a walled field, but the building's height was hard to read beneath its camouflage, perhaps a couple of stories, perhaps more. Surrounding the edge of the circular shadow of mound was a pale yellow ring that, from here, always reminded me of the white chalk figures of the Wiltshire Downs, part of a long-forgotten symbol dug forever into the earth, a future archaeology indeed. "That's Sand 14," I explained to the ethnographer, pointing to the grass dome. She only nodded, eyes on the mound as it appeared to spin clockwise, the semicircular glass window turning away from us as we passed. We turned left into what was unofficially known as Brodgar Road, the lane that led down to the tail of the isthmus, towards the stone circles of Stenness and the Ring of Brodgar itself. I pointed out the grass dome of the Neolithic passage grave of Maze Howe, pushing up over the rise on our right. Maze Howe was one of the architectural inspirations for Sand 14, I said. The other was the prehistoric settlement of Barnhouse on the loch side, which we might walk to later. You need to get a sense of the surroundings, really, to understand what's happening here. I drove in through the old gate, a vestige of the field's previous use as arable farmland, into the plastic lattice-strewn car parking area, pulling up in the waiting space before the low, grass, circular bank that surrounded the mound, now looming into the grey-soaked sky. We could now see the windows that burst out all over the mound's surface, long and tall, narrow slits, blue-green tinted panels that seemed a sea in rich soil beneath the grass, a faint submarine light coming from within their depths. The Land Rover was actually the company car, or rather bus, as it was affectionately called, and I had only borrowed it for my sojourn to the south. I tossed the keys into the first aid kit beneath my seat and threw open the door, leapt out into the cool, damp wind. A friendly gust blew a wisp of smoke from the chimney, and I breathed in the faint scent of peat. "Welcome to Sand 14," I said theatrically. I led the ethnographer around the edge of the bank, barely a foot high, to the front entrance, set back into the mound beneath a square slab of stone. The mound was a few footsteps along a stone slab causeway, surrounded on either side by a ditch filled with yellow-grey quartzite beach pebbles. The ethnographer stopped and reached down, picked up one of the heavy beach pebbles. "Looks familiar," she murmured. "That's the point," I reminded her. "Sand 14 is based on evidence. We both thread our reconstructions together from fragments of evidence. This," I waved my hands around me, is no less empirical than your imaginings of a mobile telecoms company. I dropped my rucksack to the flagstone for a moment and rummaged inside for the sheaf of printouts from my finds database, stuffed into an arts portfolio. "That's the entry I made when I collected that pebble," I said, rereading my notes. "I'll show you the mica shards when we get in. I should have noted the relationship with the chalk stone I found as part of another boundary ditch, around the edge of an Intel exhibition stand." "What's the connection?" The ethnographer was intrigued. "Well, both these beach pebbles and the chalk stone encircle and define the boundaries of a corporate space," I explained. "But the important difference is in their landscape setting. These pebbles here on Orkney are part of the landscape. They might even be from a local beach. There's a whole category of artifacts found a few miles away at the prehistoric village of Scarabray, called scale knives, which are sandstone mica cobbles just like this, sliced in half. At the exhibition stand in the London Docklands, however, the fragments of chalk have no local significance. The landscape there is one of red brick mills, metal pylons and power cables, and tidal mud. The exhibition stand boundary is deliberately evoking another landscape, an imaginary, perhaps even romantic, chalk downland. My point is the effect of the different landscapes on the boundary stones and how their meaning is transformed. The beach pebbles at your blue are not there to evoke the harsh Atlantic western edge of Orkney, even though that's where they may be found. They are placed to evoke some imaginary cobbled beach, warm pebbles underfoot, blue skies overhead, ne'er a soul to be seen, a single-sailed fishing boat on the horizon. It's a fantasy world. It's the same with the exhibition stand. The chalk was not natural in any meaningful way. It had been compressed and processed into smooth stones, never found in any chalk cliff or downland. The chalk was part of an imaginary landscape, a fictional landscape. But here, the beach cobbles evoke a local experience, are integral to the island. The other evokes your suburban employee's fantasy desires. This, I pointed back to the fields behind us and the isthmus, this landscape is where that pebble belongs, far more than at blue. I shouldered my rucksack again, and we stepped up to the heavy glass door, tinted one way so that it appeared deepest sea green to us, a dark, watery passage through which we must enter. I pushed my key against the lock. Inside was the porch that lay between the outer and inner doors. It was filled as usual with discarded walking boots and wellies, a much underused broom hanging from a hook, and a detritus of stones and mud that we kicked back into the corners. I always thought of the long glass box as an airlock, where the mud of the outside world was transformed into the pencil sharpenings and dusty threads of the indoor world. Suitably desoiled, I pushed on the next glass door, and we passed into the brightly lit foyer. It was filled with birch cafe chairs, tables, and a large, dishevelled black sofa, with a bright rug thrown over one corner. The far wall of the foyer was white, with tall slot windows that gave glimpses into the design studio beyond, between a mass of abstract paintings. The other was a series of illuminated green panels curving around the inside of the dome. The foyer was a meeting space for the company, and a large LCD screen currently showed, no doubt with someone's sense of irony, an image of the grass growing on the sides of the mound outside. Spotlights and candles were everywhere, reminding me that we were closer to the Arctic Circle than to London, closer to Norway than to France, and for large parts of the year the sun set after lunch, and darkness prevailed for most of the day. Through a tall door on our right, a tall, haphazard professor crashed in. He was dressed in a lopsided, overly large green fleece. It was Richard, my initial liaison and the founder and co-director of the design studio. He did not look like a designer, or manager, or engineer. His first degree was alleged to be in cybernetics. Or indeed any other kind of high-tech or telecoms person I had seen at work in a senior position. But my reports from others in the industry were that his mass of gold-grey unruly hair and vast eyebrows disguised, perhaps accentuated, a shrewd businessman. "Ah, morning," he said, typically distracted. "Have you seen Pierce on your travels?" Pierce's PD Parcels were the local delivery company Sand 14 used. The ethnographer and I both shook our heads. "Ah, well, we're about to get together in the kitchen. Do come and join us," he said, and flung himself back through the door, dancing deftly to the left as another body unexpectedly appeared before him. "Oh, hello there!" Anne's bright body in broad smile and thick red cardigan waltzed into the foyer. "I thought I saw the bus on its way. Did you want a hot chocolate?" It had become something of a traditional drink in the company, and we both eagerly accepted. I was certainly still feeling slightly stiff and damp from the crossing. Anne pulled open the tinted glass door, and we headed down the curving passageway, circumnavigating the edge of the design studio. Despite being an award-winning contemporary building, it was not a minimalist space. The roar of lights and abstract canvases on the walls — the other co-director was a professional painter — and plain sandstone walls made it feel somehow rough and worn, and strangely warm. As we walked past the gallery of midnight-coloured canvases to our left, there were a series of studio rooms down ramps to our right, rooms that were partly buried in the earth, their wide windows high in the walls. I peered into one room, one I had been intrigued by for several weeks. On a slab of wood above a couple of trestles was a strange woven ball of metal, almost a metre high, a mass of tangled silver strands wrapped around what was at some point in its past a sawn-off front end of a Mercedes radiator, complete with its metal logo. The wire strands had been extruded from its surface and then wrapped endlessly around its form, forming the strange ball in which the radiator grille hung, suspended, frozen in its own stratigraphy of metal layers. There was a single post-it note stuck to the wall nearby that read, "Mercedes. More natural, more human than industrial." "Very J.G. Ballard," commented the ethnographer, presumably referring to that author's infamous fascination with car crashes and the blurring of cars and bodies. That was not my reading of the piece, one of the many attempts by those at Sand 14 to create inspirational future aesthetics, but I said nothing, continued following Anne around the quarter circle of the passageway to the door to the design studio. I couldn't quite resist pausing at the door and giving the ethnographer a slight, mysterious smile of what was beyond. We stood in the doorway for a moment as I let the ethnographer's senses resonate and overwhelm her. It was a huge domed space with that vast semicircular window staring out down the loch, encircled at the last by the great undulating dark tail of the isthmus on the horizon. The low, rich silver skies, endlessly shifting clouds of metal vapour, filled your eyes from rod to cone to rod across your retina. The weight of silver danced with your gaze, as your eyes rove in wild rhythm with its flowing movement. However, that weight was counterbalanced, poised, by what lay at the heart of the mound, standing as though timeless, the hard core around which the soft mound had grown over eons. A two-story, square, sandstone building that reached to the roof, the pillar and nexus for life at Sand 14. It was around this axis that everyone sat, in an organized chaos of mismatched furniture, drawing desks and computer equipment. I pointed down at a large potted fern beside one table. The soil in the large ceramic pot had been covered with small shards of what looked like mica. Anne motioned us into the central house, as it was known, weaving us through piles of pictures, books and magazines, and endless collages of imagery stuck to propped cork boards. The ethnographer gave one of the mishmashes of magazines and post-it notes a second glance, for beneath a torn New Scientist and National Geographic pages of South American archaeological finds, it read, "Archaeology discovered." But mixed with this were other pages, including a huge, blown-up image of an artifact found at Scarabray, known only as the Scarabray Object. "We tend to work more in the house later in the year," Anne was explaining. "If we come in at all. Some days the wind is fierce. You'll get blown away into the loch before you've taken two steps out of your front door." Anne's smile was infectious. We dodged around clearly marked areas of work and personality. I nodded to Su Yin, the industrial designer, who looked up from her monitors as we passed, and finally stepped into the stone building. It always felt like entering a small house, a one-up, one-down. What always struck me was the smell, the distinctive smoke of peat. This was the kitchen, a warm parlour, the heart of the company. The unmistakable peat fire, black bricks gleaming red, burnished the air, and immediately my chill dampness, the clamour of wet weather, was gone. Much of the kitchen was filled with a dining table and assortment of chairs, more and less rickety and unupholstered. At the far end of the small room, the fire burned perpetually, alight in its stove, suspended from the ceiling. Surrounding that warmth were the mirror-hard surfaces of an industrial stainless steel kitchen, appliances, pans, drawers and cupboards all suffused with the corrosive orange glow. A spiral staircase beside us led to the library on the floor above. On a warm plastic chair, back to a corner facing the hearth, an older woman in designer black with an orange scarf sat, tapping furiously on a laptop. She glanced up. But Anne said, "Oh, don't worry, George, I'll get them something to drink." "Oh, would you? I'm just really up against it right now." Georgina, the co-director, gave us both a brief smile. "Sorry, I'll be with you in a moment," and returned to her rapid movements over a mouse pad. It was a tradition at San 14 that the fire was kept burning, partly out of necessity, so I conscientiously threw another briquette on the hearth. Anne handed us two large cups, or rather bowls, of hot chocolate, and other members of the company began to drift in. Richard launched into the room, hopping with nervous energy from one foot to the other, and gabbling at high speed to Simon, the flamboyant prototyping engineer, who was calmly making notes and sketches, dyed white spiked hair soaring through the air. Georgina then leapt to her feet and, with businesslike efficiency, formed our disarray into a discussion appropriately watered with hot drinks. Richard quickly held court at the table as usual, leaning in furtively over his black tea, eyebrows bouncing up and down as he spoke. I leaned in to the ethnographer. "They're discussing the camera phone models which Richard saw in London a few days ago," I explained. The ethnographer gave me a sharp, surprised glance, but I motioned her to be still. "I have to say, I was a bit surprised," Richard began. "I rather thought the models looked like props from a 1950s science fiction movie." "It's the whole retro thing," commented George with a sigh. "All white and bulbous curves. It's just totally uninspired. It doesn't engage with the world at all. It's a fantasy of styles from the past. Oh, I know it's terribly popular, but I just hate it." Richard rolled on, fingers weaving the air as though incanting a spell. "Well, I then wandered into the British Library, and I didn't realise, but some of Tim Ingold's recent work on multi-sensory communication talks about the importance of the lived experience as opposed to the reification of the senses.
I think this is crucial for us. What we are doing is transforming, or rather translating, an experience of the world, not of the individual senses. It's the transformation rather than the transmission which is central. Our work is really about how to transform an experience through silicon and radio into something else.
And something no less magical, murmured Anne.
But we have been really focused on haptics and force feedback recently.
Simon looked worried.
Ah, don't worry, this is definitely not a redirection, Richard explained. I think we just need to keep it absolutely clear in our minds that we are not, he emphasised, designing a multi-sensory communications device as a kind of evolution of voice and camera phones. That would be quite wrong. What we are doing is generative. We are trying to translate a bit of the world into something else, which will hopefully be something a little extraordinary. He gave a sudden, quick grin. I guess it's like painting.
I don't think it's anything of the sort, Richard, said George in pique. I accept it might be like photography, which is a translation of the world into a flat, timeless rectangle with a single point of perspective, but it's not painting. The conversation bounced back and forth for a while, with the three sociocultural researchers, Anne, the ethnographer, and I sharing a quiet space between it all. Finally, George, who as both artist and businesswoman always insisted on the salient details, asked Richard how he might pitch their radically different design concept to the mobile telecoms industry. There was a pause, and Richard leaned back.
Ah, now that is an interesting issue.
It was an issue I knew would not be easily solved, one upon which their viability as a business rested. How might their version of the future be made as part of the mobile telecoms industry future? But it was a question that would not be answered today. The discussion disbanded, and everyone drifted off, thinking hard. The ethnographer and I caught up with Simon. I was eager to show the ethnographer what the engineer had meant by haptics and force feedback, show her the effect of this landscape on the future of the mobile telecoms industry. We walked around the assortment of working areas to Simon's own world. He had set up a couple of thin metal work benches and a floor of paperwork in front of the wall of window, with the waters and beach almost at arm's length beyond the storm-enforced glass panels. I scanned his desk. Lots of paper, pens, a pot of some fragrant herb, a planisphere, an old CD player and chewed-up headphones. And there was one of the white frosted glass bowls on his chair, still full of hot chocolate. There was also a large, old-fashioned rubberized laptop closed and leaning against the window, with a polished quartzite pebble resting on its clasp. I picked up the pebble, and the ethnographer asked him if it was important. "Feel it," he replied, looking at me. I pressed the stone between my thumb and forefinger and rubbed its surface, felt the coldness, the smoothness, but also a slight crease in the surface, a fracture which drew my thumb. "You feel the fracture?" he asked. I nodded. "Well, that's what I'm really interested in. The imperfection draws your fingers, doesn't it? But it's the colour, the translucency of the polished stone that draws your attention." "How does that lead to a mobile device?" asked the ethnographer, alert. Simon rummaged on his desk, pulled aside a few maps, and revealed a strange, glistening black object shaped like a rounded and elegantly sculpted letter T. The ethnographer immediately glanced over to the distant collage of the scarabray object, eyes widening with recognition. The object was not entirely black. In its depths were pale arteries of white, nor was it completely smooth. It was etched with some grid pattern at the top. Simon held the maps back and invited me to grasp the object. The shaft fitted easily down between my fingers and the handle snuggled comfortably into my palm. It was like holding some kind of designer bottle opener. The silken surface felt like sun-warmed marble, heavy but gorgeous to touch. Instinctively, I squeezed it and felt the give of two pressure pads beneath my knuckles. A light appeared at one end, projecting down onto the floor. Then, extraordinary waves of what felt like cool water began to lap up and down my fingers. It was delicious. I realized there was a smudge of blue in the light on the carpet and put my other palm into the beam to bring it into focus. It was a picture of someone's hand dangling in lapping water, and I heard a slightly distorted voice from the object whisper, "Can you feel that?" I could. I had not seen the device working before and had no idea of its effect. I didn't know what to say, almost dropped the device and gave it back to Simon. "That's..." I began and gave up. Simon grinned. "Isn't it just..."